Ladies and gentlemen, the committee of the Modern Law Review have asked me to say something about the special nature of today's occasion. The 25th lecture in the series that we founded in honour of Lord Chorley, the holder of the Castle Chair of Commercial Law, or as it was then for 16 years, the holder of the Sir Ernest Castle Chair of Commercial and Industrial Law. And as a general editor emeritus, and once having held the chair, perhaps I may very briefly outline the way in which this annual lecture came to be established. We founded it in 1971 in his honour, not waiting, as so often is done, for people to die before things are founded in their honour, but while he still was with us, and when he laid down the burdens of the general editorship of the review, after he'd brought it to maturity and to the front rank of law reviews from the very first number in 1937, through the war, when he served both in the Cheshire Regiment and as a civil servant, and a time in the war when, but for him, there's no doubt the new Modern Law Review would have collapsed. That was one reason for the lectures. But he was a truly remarkable man, far beyond that. Before the war, he was a central figure in the London Law Faculty, and more generally, he was foremost amongst those at the school who helped to snatch scholars and others from the emergent tyranny of Nazism. Amongst those, of course, was Otto Kahn-Freund, who found that he shared with Theo Chorley not only a radical outlook on law and its teaching, but also a passion for hill walking and climbing. Theo Chorley's only London club was the Alpine Club. And over many years as president or in some other officer capacity, in a wide range of organisations that linked climbing with the preservation of the countryside, he gave very much very great activity. The British Mountaineering Club, Council for the Preservation of Rural England, the Fell Rock Climbing Club, Commons and Footpaths Preservation Society, National Trust, and so on. Now, after the law, those were dominant interests, but you can look at who was who to find a wide range of other activities to which a host of bodies to which he gave unselfish labour until his death in 1978. He published primarily on commercial law and banking law. He was made a fellow of the Institute of Bankers in 1960, relevant for us this evening, and a Silk in 1961. Over many years, he held the presidency or similar office in a range of important bodies: the Howard League for Penal Reform, Institute for the Study of Delinquency, Haldane Society, National Council for the Abolition of the Death Penalty, and the going was much tougher then in that field. His work in office and out for our professional bodies, the Association of University Teachers and the Society of Public Teachers of Law, was unstinting. And he was joint editor of a volume in the 1960s, Law Reform Now, which, if you look at it, you can compare in its radicalism, civilized radicalism, which bears his touch compared with some programs now. And yet, I've heard him say this, in other words, much of that was founded on a disappointment. Those of us who saw so many friends in 1945 go into the House of Commons in the Labour landslide of that year, some for good, others for careers as ministers, often wonder what they might have done for society had they not succeeded at that general election. Now, some of you might keep an eye on those of your generation who may be about to repeat the experience. But that was Theo Chorley's condition, because he had stood as a candidate, a Labour candidate, in 1945, but was not elected. Instead, he became a peer, Lord Chorley of Kendal, the place from which he came. And in those days, no half measures were allowed. You had to commit your offspring to a hereditary title as well as yourself. And the law lords apart, there were no life peerages. In 1946, he also resigned his castle chair at the London School of Economics and became a very junior government minister in the House of Lords until 1950. It's a post which is still called a lord in waiting. To some extent, his dissatisfaction with this oddly attendant position, where his talents were undoubtedly underused, and his other interests, all enriched not only the bodies to which I've referred, but also especially the Modern Law Review as founder and general editor for 26 years. One of the founders who had dared with the others to write on page one of volume one in 1937. This is how they put it. The technical aspects of the law must always remain indispensable. But a group of lawyers, meaning themselves, have for some time been thinking that it isolates the law too much from its contemporary social conditions in which it must always operate. You must remember how bold it was to make this step of a new journal. There were some, including certain law lords, some of whom are still alive, who deeply resented the foundation of a journal which might challenge the intellectual supremacy of the Law Quarterly Review. Theo Chorley worked tirelessly to explore the new frontiers which this stance required, yet with modest statements of that sort, and it was a small measure of recompense to found an annual lecture, and for this to be the 25th lecture on which his work in all respects is remembered. And that does lead me, in some degree perhaps might explain, this evening's lecture. For the name of Goodhart is celebrated and well known to the law in this as well as previous generations. But it is to Professor Goodhart, the economist of the family, that we turn to address us today on the relationships between law and economics. Our lecturer, Charles Goodhart, has taught both here and in the Cambridge Faculty of Economics. He served as an advisor to the Bank of England and as chief advisor in 1980. He is established here in the school with Professor Mervyn King, the financial markets group. He has a reputation of being one of those economists that you or even lawyers can talk to without the help of an overhead projector. I wrote that before I saw what was happening this evening. In 1985, he became the Norman Sosno Professor of Banking and Finance here at the London School of Economics. He's author of a formidable array of books, including The Evolution of Central Banks, Money, Information and Uncertainty, and in 1995, Central Bank and the Financial System. And it's with very great pleasure that I ask him to address us today on economics and law, too much one-way traffic.
Thank you very much, Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. When Professor Simon Roberts asked me to give this Chorley lecture, he told me that this would be the first time that an economist had done so. And it is indeed appropriate that an economist should have been asked to talk on the subject of economics and the law here, particularly so because LSE was the site where Ronald Coase did his formative work under the supervision of Arnold Plant. As Coase's biographer, Medima, writes, there can be no doubt that Coase's career was largely shaped by his LSE experience. Coase's work here was later to develop into his paper on the problem of social cost, which is famous for being the source of the Coase theorem. And that theorem, slightly oversimplified, is that if transactions are costless, the initial assignment of a property right will not affect the ultimate use of that property. Now, that theorem and Coase's analytical work more generally provided one of the main foundations of the economic legal approach to law, whose best known proponent is probably now Judge Richard Posner in the USA. Now, I have chosen to concentrate primarily on Coase's contributions, but Hayek provides yet another LSE link between the two disciplines, and I shall also briefly mention his work towards the close of this lecture. I see the lawyers don't like the overhead projectors. It seems, come on again. Now, whereas it is in fact appropriate that an economist should give this lecture, I've come to realize with ever increasing clarity as this date came ever closer that it really should not have been me. So why did I accept the invitation in the first place? Especially if I may quote Ralph Dahrendorf's opening sentence when he gave the same lecture in 1976. He said, "It is perhaps understandable that a non-lawyer invited to deliver this distinguished lecture and even threatened by its publication in a law review feels a sense of awe and embarrassment." Now, there are a number of reasons. First, it is hard to refuse an offer to give such a prestigious lecture when it is made so far in advance. One can hardly plead a prior commitment over a year ahead. Second, this must be one of the very few such lectures which my father, Arthur Goodhart, had not himself given, so there was a matter of family pride to complete the set. And finally, I did think that there was one issue that I could develop, which is that economists tend to take the legal underpinnings of the economy far too much for granted, and I shall return to that in a moment or two, since it represents my first major topic. But when eventually I came to prepare for this lecture, I felt that I should read much more widely in the area, thereby trespassing on fields outside my own familiar areas of banking and the foreign exchange market. And that reading, not surprisingly, reinforced my own sense of inadequacy. But what really struck me as I browsed through the some six or so journals dedicated to the study of the interaction between law and economics is that the vast majority of the contributions seem to involve the application of economic methodology to the law. So in the main, the relationship between economics and the law involves one-way traffic from economics to the law. In his fascinating paper on evolutionary models in economics and law, cooperation versus conflict strategies, Hirschleifer notes that, and I quote, "In recent years, there has been growing intellectual interchange between legal and economic scholars. The dominant influence, it seems fair to say, has been economics, in the sense that economic propositions have been borrowed or applied to provide new or more fundamental explanations of certain legal phenomena. And that is perhaps epitomized in Judge Posner's great textbook on the economic analysis of law, now into its fourth edition." Economics has become an increasingly and unashamedly imperialist social science in recent decades. And you in the law represent one of our finest colonies. Whereas the conquistadores in Latin America had steel swords and horses to carry all before them, our own economics conquistadores, Ronald Coase, Guido Calabresi, Gary Becker, and Richard Posner among them, have something much more powerful, a unifying methodology, particularly in the form of constrained maximization. The success and scope of such colonization becomes apparent as soon as one samples the law and economics literature. For example, in the latest complete volume of the Journal of Law and Economics, the oldest such journal, that I found in the Robbins Library, the opening three papers in the first April issue cover issues, subjects such as the optimal level of penal sanctions and the optimal level of enforcement effort and accuracy. Secondly, the economically efficient level of public expenditure on AIDS education programs. And thirdly, the determination of whether the white settlers in America would choose to negotiate with the indigenous Red Indians in order to obtain additional land or to use force to dispossess them. This latter was augmented by the use of economists' standard empirical calibrating mechanism, the multiple regression. For those who may be skeptical about this latter, I am going to show you now one of the three such multiple regressions actually included in that particular paper. Now, that is the economist's way of showing the battle between the cowboys and the Indians, or rather between the US cavalry and the Indians. I don't want to go into it in any detail, but you can see how we try and do this kind of measurement. Now, such examples can be extended, if not ad infinitum, certainly ad nauseam. As a card-carrying professional economist, I can, however, only applaud the application of good economic methodology to other domains, including legal issues. And indeed, I've tried to do and continue with similar work myself, especially in the field of financial regulation. To take but two examples, I'm presently concerned with issues relating to the measurement of benefits from such financial regulation, when this cannot easily be done through the price mechanism, and also on devising an incentive structure that might induce financial institutions to take on an optimal amount of risk. I need not remind you that the economist sees the law desirably operating as a means of applying and maintaining appropriate incentive structures in society. Nevertheless, there may be limits to how far one can push the economic analysis of the law, and it could be, I think, important to establish where these might be. So my second and more ambitiously daring theme will be to explore whether and where there are boundaries to the ambit of the Coase theorem and to the economic analysis of the law more generally. Finally, much of the analytical work on the economic analysis of the law has been done in the US, and especially in Chicago. The attitude of such scholars to government regulation in particular, and to statute law in general, has been somewhat colored by the nature of the structure of and the pressures on Congress in the USA. The position of the legislature in the UK is rather different in a number of important respects. And such differences mean that the shortcomings that we may expect to find in the application of statute law in this country are also of a rather different form. Let me turn back, however, to my first theme, the influence of law both on the economy and on the study of economics. The effect of the rule of law on the economy is pervasive, but rarely examined in any great depth by economists. Again, Ronald Coase was an exception to this dictum. Now, like many lawyers, the less confident you are of your material, or I am of my material, the more that you rely on precedent and prior quotations from earlier authority. The frequency and length of my quotations would take up far too much time to read, so I have collected and distributed them separately. Now I'm going to refer to each relevant quotation by a letter of the alphabet. Anyhow, let me start with two of Coase's insights that I found particularly compelling. The first is that private competitive markets depend on a comprehensive legal structure. That's set out in quote A. And this viewpoint has been re-emphasized by Manker Olson in his latest monograph, Capitalism, Socialism, and Dictatorship, and Olson's views are set out in quotation B. Now, the second of Coase's insights that I have selected here is that economists' standard approach to the analysis of factors of production is incomplete because it treats factors as physical entities rather than as collections of certain limited rights to enjoying the services of such entities. And that's set out in quote C. And I would note that in this respect, lawyers are rather better in that they naturally tend to regard factors of production as rights to such services rather than entities in themselves. Coase certainly felt that the analysis of how the law affected economic behavior was crucial to a proper study of our own subject, set out in quote D. In his excellent paper summarizing the legal and economic literature that followed Coase's 1960 article, Parisi records in a footnote some comments made by Coase at a conference in March 1981, bringing together a distinguished group of scholars who had directly contributed to the birth of the law and economics movement. Coase then said, and I quote, "I might add something about Britain. The antecedents to events when I went to LSE have been left out. One has to realize that British economists have never been hostile to the study of law. In fact, they've always encouraged people. They thought that economists ought to study law, or at least they used to." Edward Cannon, who was a professor that Plant studied with, and also Lionel Robbins, was very anxious that economists should study law and supported the development of the law faculty at LSE. Essentially, the older generation of British economists were not hostile, but welcomed the introduction of law into their studies. However, that influence has really disappeared. End of quotes. And Coase later complained, after he'd received his Nobel Prize in 1991, that economics had become extremely abstract in general, and the references to law or any other institution are rarely found. There are a few fields within economics in which the influence of the legal system on economic behaviour continues to be treated as of central importance, and these are primarily areas where statute law is concerned with the regulation of industrial and financial activity. But in the main, Coase is surely correct, both in his factual observation that the role of law rarely now enters economists' studies, and to deplore that fact. It is hard, however, to establish a negative. Yet, as an example, I went to 12 mainstream textbooks on economics and looked up references to the law and to the legal system. There were many references to laws, but these were almost economists' own laws of demand and supply, the law of one price, of comparative advantage, of diminishing marginal utility, and so on, rather than the laws of the legal system. And while there were many references to legal tender, there was hardly one to the legal system. The absence of much concern with the underlying role of the legal system for a well-functioning market economy may be particularly marked in the UK. Campbell and Wiles, in their 1976 paper on the study of law in society, concluded that in comparison with the position in America, economists in Britain have virtually ignored studies of law or the relevance of legal regulation to economic development. Even in those areas where one might have expected good economists to consider the influence of the law on economic behavior, one often draws something of a blank. Let me take as an example of a really good economist, our erstwhile LSE colleague, Oliver Hart, and as a subject where surely one might have expected some assessment of what role the law could play, the theory of incomplete contracts. Yet when I read Hart's work on incomplete contracts and property rights, what strikes me is how little specific reference there is to the relevance of the law in this field, with the exception of bankruptcy, on which I shall comment in a moment. For example, in Hart's recent book, Firms, Contracts, and the Financial Structure, apart from the chapter on bankruptcy, there is one quote from Holmes, The Common Law, and a reference to the Coase theorem, but otherwise the legal infrastructure is just taken for granted. Matters may be improving a bit. I recently begged from Oliver a copy of his latest joint work on the proper scope of government, theory and an application to prisons, a paper which I felt that, given the title, there would surely be some reference to legal issues in it. Now, the key question in that latest paper by Oliver, C quote E, is how far can contracts be used to ensure the maintenance of quality, such as, for example, the quality of treatment of prison inmates by their guards? Now, that must be at least in part a factual question, which one can only hope to answer by looking at the legal position. And Oliver and his co-authors specifically mention one court case, Medina versus O'Neill, 1984, which is a rarity for economists to even quote a case, and they make a more general reference later to an examination of our sources on contracts, unspecified. So why do economists usually take so little notice of the legal underpinnings of the economic system? My own provisional answer to that is because most of the time such legal underpinnings can be taken pretty much as a constant, and therefore the law does not represent a variable whose adjustment becomes involved in our standard exercises of constrained maximization. Cento Veljanovsky concurs when he states in his Hobart paper that, and I quote, the general inclination, particularly though not exclusively of British economists, is to treat the law as a datum. It is only when there is a sudden prospective change in legal conditions that this impinges on day-to-day economic developments. But when such a major change happens, it can represent the dominant determinant of economic developments. Let me give you one personal example, which relates to the future of Hong Kong after 1997. Both my own judgment and that of many other experts is that the key to Hong Kong's future success will be the maintenance of a fair, comprehensible, and acceptable legal system, especially for commercial law. As Ralph Dahrendorf stated in his earlier Chorley lecture, democracy is precious, But the rule of law is indispensable, and the two often do not go together. The importance of the rule of law and the structure of the legal system on the economy is clearly profound, but very difficult to measure with the economist's normal bag of tricks, since the law varies only occasionally and then in discrete jumps, whilst our calculus requires continuously differentiable variables. One recent heroic attempt at such measurement was undertaken by Bob Barrow in this year's Robbins Lectures. He was looking for factors affecting the determinants of economic growth in a cross-section study of a large number of countries. One of his variables was an index of the rule of law, and this turned out in his regression study to be one of the most important basic determinants per capita growth, just as important as education and as important as having a low rate of population growth and inflation. Barrow had 7 values of his index of the rule of law, and every time that you rose one step in the index, growth went up by 0.5%. Now that may not sound all that much, but a 3% difference in per capita growth between the best and the worst countries soon accumulates into a huge difference in levels. Barrow's findings that adherence to the rule of law enhances growth are not necessarily inconsistent with the empirical results of 2 earlier studies, which suggested that economic growth is negatively correlated with the proportionate number of lawyers and of law students in a country. Many countries which adhere most steadfastly to the rule of law are not litigious. One may think of Japan and other Asian countries. The number of lawyers may be related more to litigiousness than to reverence for the rule of law as such. One of those studies contrasted the proportional college enrollment of engineering students, which they found to be positively related to growth, with that of law students, which was negatively related. The authors ascribed this difference to whether the most talented young people were being attracted into careers that directed ingenuity, ideas, and resources into growth-promoting activities, as with engineering, or what they felt to be into redistributional zero-sum activities, in this case, the way they typified the law. Now, what is interesting here is the difference between those economists' vision of the law as essentially a mechanism for achieving redistribution on the basis of concepts of equity and justice, and the new legal economic vision of the law, as represented by Posner, for example, which sees the law as an alternative and supplement to the private market pricing mechanism when transactions costs are very high for achieving an efficient wealth-maximizing outcome. And I'll return to that issue again later. Because changes in the law tend, by our standards, to occur rarely and then in discrete jumps, we economists often find it hard to take proper account of the true importance of the legal system. One such example may be found in our failure to predict and understand the outcome of the collapse of the communist system in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. Initially, many economists predicted, largely by analogy with the successful recovery of Western Europe after World War II, that a combination of an educationally skilled workforce in Eastern Europe, reasonably good access to raw materials and land, but a very poor quality stock of capital, would lead to a huge inward flow of capital from the West, and fairly soon to a rapid recovery towards Western living standards. That did not happen at the outset. And one important reason that has been adduced for that failure was an initial lack of a framework of a generally acceptable, comprehensible, and fair system of commercial and contract law in these countries, and in some parts of the former Soviet Union, a widespread breakdown in the rule of law more generally. The attempt to introduce capitalism in these latter circumstances tends to lead to a form of mafia capitalism, which the ordinary person and voter will reject in disgust. At least, however, the upheavals in the former communist countries have made economists realize that the law itself can be a potential variable and not necessarily a constant part of the infrastructure. Indeed, it was the need to introduce new bankruptcy laws, ab initio, into certain Eastern European countries that made some of my economist colleagues, notably Philippe Aguillon, Oliver Hart, and John Moore, turn towards a study of how the laws on bankruptcy ought to be revised in order to achieve a Keynesian wealth maximization. They would, I think, as a result of their efforts, dispute the Posner theorem that the law would naturally evolve in that direction anyhow. Now, that perhaps is a good point for turning from my first theme, that economists in general take insufficient notice of the importance of the legal underpinnings of the economy, to my second theme, which is that there is some tendency for there to be a belief in some quarters that economics can provide an answer for more legal questions than is actually the case. Especially in a lecture on law and economics at LSE, it is appropriate to kick off any discussion on whether and what limits there might be to the economic analysis of the law by reverting to yet another reconsideration of the Coase theorem. This theorem, alongside Calabresi's 1961 paper on some thoughts on risk distribution and the law of torts, provided the initial foundation for the development of the application of economics to law. As Posner states, this theorem represents the most celebrated application of the concept of opportunity cost in the economic analysis of law. As already noted, the theorem, slightly oversimplified, is that if transactions are costless, the initial assignment of a property right will not affect the ultimate use of a property. Building on that foundation and extending it, particularly with the application of the principle established by Judge Learned Hand in the U.S. versus Carroll Towing Company, 1947, that the defendant's culpability should be determined by balancing the burden of adequate precautions against the likelihood of an accident multiplied by the seriousness of the harm should the accident occur, Posner and like-minded scholars have shown just how far and how deeply the structure of the law can be shown to have economic roots. Posner begins his study on the economic analysis of law by stating that, and I quote, "This book is written in the conviction that economics is a powerful tool for analyzing a vast range of legal questions, but that most lawyers and law students have difficulty connecting economic principles to concrete legal problems." Later on, the start of chapter 2, he notes that the hallmark of the new law and economics is the application of economics to the legal system across the board, to common law fields such as torts, contracts, restitution and property, to the theory and practice of punishment, to civil, criminal, and administrative procedure, to the theory of legislation and regulation, to law enforcement and judicial administration, and even to constitutional primitive law, admiralty law, family law, and jurisprudence. Economics, indeed, has become increasingly imperialist. But imperialism is not ipso facto misguided. If I may paraphrase Kipling, it may bring enlightenment to lesser subjects without the economics. The work of Gary Becker and Richard Posner has been powerful, often subtle, and most influential. But let me get back to the Coase theorem. Coase had already shown in his celebrated paper on the theory of the firm that without transactions costs, all the organizational and operational functions undertaken by firms in the economy could be carried out just as easily through markets. But this did not, however, mean that firms were unimportant, ephemeral, or transient features of the economy. It was rather that transactions costs were pervasive and crucial in the real world. Similarly, Coase showed in The Problem of Social Cost that absent transactions costs, property and property rights would always be put to its most efficient use, since the person who valued it most highly could make an offer to an owner who valued it less that the owner could not refuse. So why then do we need laws of property, trespass, compulsory purchase, and so on? In part, it is because the transactions costs of reaching a settlement through a process of private bargaining are often extremely high. Where there are only two parties involved, so that we have a state of bilateral monopoly, and the value placed by the potential buyer of the right to occupy land, to commit a nuisance, and so on, is much higher than the alternative value placed on it by the current owner, then there are a very wide range of possible welfare-improving bargains. Which particular outcome would be reached might depend so much on strategic bargaining, threats, and so on, that there could be advantage in bringing in a neutral third party in the form of the law in order to reduce transactions costs. Alternatively, when there are many parties to the bargaining process, there are many serious potential problems in organizing an efficient process of bargaining through private markets. For example, free rider problems, holdouts, and so forth. In some respects, the Coase theorem is a tautology, because, as Posner notes, at bottom, all it says is that if there are gains from trade, rational parties will trade, and if not, not. So the claim that in such circumstance the final allocation of the property right will be put to its most efficient use can hardly be doubted. The final use will be independent of the initial ownership. In Coase's most famous analogy about the potential damage caused by the cattle rancher's cattle invading the farmer's wheat field, the optimal, most efficient form of damage prevention will be agreed, whether it is the farmer or the rancher which has the liability whenever the cattle stray out into the farmer's territory. And that is indeed so. But the actual transfers of money to achieve that optimal allocation, and so the effect on relative wealth, do depend on the initial ownership position. In the farmer-rancher case in Coase's original paper, whether the farmer or the cattle rancher is liable for the damage done by the cattle straying onto the wheat fields, the optimal size of herd and or expenditure on fencing remains unchanged. But when the rancher is liable, he pays the farmer for the damage or erects the fences, and vice versa when the farmer is liable. Now, Coase goes on to state, and I quote, "Of course, if market transactions were costless, all that matters, questions of equity apart, is that the rights of the various parties should be well defined and the results of legal actions easy to forecast." But for the law to ignore questions of equity is rather like asking Mrs. Lincoln whether she otherwise liked the play. And that criticism has been made by many economists, and no doubt lawyers also. Coase reverts to this question in his section on the assignment of rights and the distribution of wealth in his notes on the problem of social cost. Here he argues, and I quote, that a change in the liability rule will not lead to any alteration in the distribution of wealth if transactions costs are really zero. See quote F. Now, I have no problem with Coase's formal logic in the quote that I have given you. Effectively, if at the outset, time zero, all possible contingencies can be foreseen, costlessly contracted upon, and all such contracts can thenceforth be costlessly and perfectly enforced, then we are in what economists describe as a certainty equivalent world in which legal changes would not affect wealth distributions. But we do not live in that world, nor in anything approximately close to it, as Coase would surely be the first to agree. Consequently, legal judgments will have effects on equity, and prior anticipations of those effects will inevitably be limited. What is noticeable to someone coming new and innocently to the work of Coase and Posner is that in their discussion of property rights, there is so little history. In the stories of the rancher and the farmer, or of the farmer and the spark-emitting railway, we are simply told that the two parties exist and that the activity of one party adversely affects the other, not whether one had got there first and whether that party could reasonably then foresee the arrival of the second party. Posner, however, faces that problem head on. Let me offer you two passages from the Economic Analysis of the Law in quotes G and H. There are two reasons why I find Posner's position on this unconvincing. The first remains within the field of economics. If you give priority to the first in time, it will give the incomer an incentive to locate his activity where it will have the least damaging effect. The railroad would be induced to place its tracks where the combined costs of track laying and spark emitting would be least. Similarly, if coming to the nuisance is a bar to suits, the initial location of housing would be more carefully planned. Only if the incomer can give supporting evidence that he or she had already carefully chosen the site with the least overall social cost before setting up shop, would I agree with Posner that history should not matter? And most of the legal cases which Coase criticizes, such as Bryant versus Lefevre and Bass versus Gregory, are in large part about history, about who was the incomer and whether the incomer should be liable. The second, perhaps more compelling reason why I find Posner's arguments unconvincing is that they often seem contrary to our personal beliefs in fairness and in our beliefs in rights and wrongs, which are deep-seated. In the paper which I've already cited by Hirschleifer, he refers to the difficulties of inducing cooperative behavior among members of a society in situations where aggressive and opportunist behavior may often seem to pay off better. When should you fight and when should you submit? And how will such decisions affect the evolution of the group and society as a whole? Hirschleifer argues that a bourgeois rule may help to overcome many such cooperation failures. The bourgeois rule is as follows. When you are a first-comer in possession of a resource, play like a hawk. When a latecomer, play like a dove. That is, when an owner, fight to defend your property. When an interloper, defer to others' ownership. When the law ignores the deeply held feelings that ownership, even if only in the sense of having got there in possession first, creates rights which can and should be vigorously defended, it does so at the peril of losing public support. Witness the outcry when the physical assault by a homeowner on a criminal trespasser is itself treated as a serious crime. If indeed evolution has programmed the majority of us both to stand up for our own rights and to defer to the prior ownership of others, then a large number of law cases will, indeed must, arise where both parties believe that they have such rights on their own side. In such instances, cooperation to achieve the mutual gains of trade are likely to fly out of the window, since both parties will attempt to act as uncompromising hawks. See quote I. Let me take a second example where the legal economics approach seems to elevate the achievement of allocative economic efficiency in a rather narrow static sense above our concepts of justice and equity. This is in the area of specific performance and efficient breach of contract and promises. The courts have power, in some cases, to make an order for specific performance of a contract. This compels a party in breach of the contract to perform his obligations rather than pay damages for non-performance. It has been argued that the remedy for specific performance is economically inefficient and should be abandoned. If I may quote from my brother, William Goodhart and Gareth Jones, they state that the modern economic theory may be tersely summarized as follows. Efficient breach argues that contracting parties will breach and pay damages when it is profitable for them to do so, and that the law should encourage such breaches because they will lead to a more efficient allocation of scarce resources. Also see quote J. Goodhart and Gareth Jones disagree with this position on several grounds. First, there is some moral indignation at allowing people to break contracts and promises just because it pays them to do so. Second, damages are often undercompensatory. Third, they write, when a man makes a contract, wrote Buckland, he acquires or confers something. The economic situation is changed in some way which the law will take into account. A party has acquired what we have been in the habit of calling a right, and the Romans called a res. As a modern commentator puts it, what is at stake is the allocation of entitlements. Also see quote K. Now, to those general arguments, I would add a broader economic argument. And that is that the ability of both parties to a contract to be able to rely on its being carried out as specifically agreed, except under extreme circumstances, will much reduce transactions costs themselves. The greater the uncertainty whether the promise or contract will be kept as actually agreed, or will have to involve a lengthy and possibly costly process of suing for an uncertain amount of damages, the more both parties will have to spend scarce time and managerial effort on contingency planning. I accept that specific performance may reduce allocative efficiency in individual cases, but it may at the same time maximize overall economic efficiency in the large by enabling all parties to reduce their transactions costs by being able to rely more on the performance of their counterparty. Although I have given some economic arguments why I am less than convinced by Posner's arguments on the appropriate allocation of property rights or on efficient breach, in my own views, these matters far less than the likelihood than Posner's positions there seem contrary to most people's views of what is fair and just. Wealth maximization is indeed a proper goal both for society and for the legal system within it, but can and should that objective be pursued without due recognition of what that same society regards as just and fair outcomes? I rather doubt it. So, an intangible but pervasive concern with the perceived fairness and justice of legal outcomes is the first limit that I believe exists to the application of economic reasoning to the law. The second limit concerns what both we individually and, more importantly, what the state can do to our bodies. Most of the cases where Posner and others have found that the law is in contradiction with the tenets of economic analysis lie in this field. In general, the economist will approve of free competitive markets with full access to information and some restriction on access for those unable to assess such information, for example, the young, and taxation where demand is inelastic and there may be subsequent adverse effects from the exchange which will involve state expenditures, such as hospitals for lung cancer and police to curb drunken rowdiness. And that is broadly indeed what currently happens with tobacco and drink, but not so in the cases of prostitution, narcotics, surrogate motherhood, adoption, and so on, where the free market is suppressed by law. What we should be able to do to our own bodies is widely regarded as being largely beyond the limits of economics. And this is especially so and the question of what the state should be allowed to do to our bodies. In the section on optimal criminal sanctions, in the chapter on criminal law, in his economic analysis of law, Posner only considers fines, imprisonment, and capital punishment for murder. And most economists in this school, such as Gary Becker, also concentrate solely or primarily on the alternatives of fines or prison. But traditionally, there has always been another form of punishment in the nature of the infliction of pain by the state on offenders short of capital punishment. By any standards you like to name, prison is horribly cost inefficient, and most criminals are not capable of paying large fines. The purposeful infliction of pain on criminals by society surely deters, costs a great deal less than raising either the probability of apprehension or the length or unpleasantness of prison sentencing. And it can be calibrated to achieve appropriate marginal deterrence. Short of capital punishment, the infliction of pain is no more or less irreversible than time spent in prison, and if found to be erroneous, both can be compensated by cash payments. Flogging and cutting off peripheral bits of people's bodies would, by standard economic criteria, be far more wealth maximizing for society than prison sentences. And yet a society that flogged and amputated is not one that I would want to embrace. So when it comes to the questions of who should be allowed to do what to our bodies, we economists will just have to accept a boundary to our imperial grasp. Now, I have criticized Posner for overstepping in a few cases the proper limits to the application of economic analysis of the law. I should like to make some slight amends to him by regaling you with a paragraph, which is set out in quote M, from his section on civil and criminal procedures that helps to illuminate the recent dispute between the Home Secretary and the judiciary on fixed sentencing. If I'm going to move on now to my third section on government and law. Now, if one takes the Coase theorem to its logical conclusion, it should also hold for societal organizations such as politics and the law. In other words, that we should always move to a more efficient wealth-maximizing world. And that is reported in quote N from the latest monograph by Manker Olson. Yet, as Olson goes on to state, it is patently impossible to believe that no matter how much or what kind of government interventionism is observed, the status quo is efficient. Governments and politics are clearly the source of some absurdly inefficient outcomes. And perhaps war offers the simplest proof that there are outcomes that are not Pareto efficient. If we ask why politics and government are not necessarily subject to the conclusions of the Coase theorem, the answer obviously is because both sides to the outcome have not voluntarily agreed to it. Indeed, one side, the weaker or losing side, can be coerced by the power of the government. Whoever runs the government, whether it be a democratic majority, a dictator, or industrial lobbyists, can concern themselves only with maximizing their own welfare, without too many worries about the effects on the losers, subject only to ensuring that they can retain their hold over power. And it was on the basis of that kind of argument that many academics, from Hayek, another LSE Nobel Prize winner, on to Richard Posner again, have distinguished between the common law, judge-made law, which is, they assert, conditioned by the Coase theorem to evolve towards economic efficiency, and statute or government-made law, which does not benefit from any such invisible hand. See quotes O and P. Such a sharp distinction between the likely effects of the common law, seen as generally beneficial, and of statute law, which may be good, bad, or indifferent, remains contentious. Some of you will remember that in an earlier Chorley lecture in 1984, P.S. Attia questioned how far these two branches of the law could and should be distinguished. And I put a quote from him in quote Q. And on his reading, the attempt to divide the law into a privately evolving Hayekian good branch, the common law, and a governmental Hayekian dubious or even undesirable branch, statute law, is grossly oversimplified and unwarranted. Perhaps even more fundamentally, some have argued that certain of the factors in society that may cause statute law on occasions to be inefficient could have a similar influence on the common law. For example, the development of economic legal analysis in the USA has been largely conditioned by their findings that industrial regulation has generally appeared to work to the benefit of the regulated industry and not of the consumer more widely. And that has led to the identification of the chief demon in the perversion of statute law as being the tightly knit, cohesive, and wealthy single interest group, which through their agents, the lobbyist, is able to suborn the legislature, i.e. Congress. But just as wealthy, cohesive interest groups can throw money at the legislature to get their way, so they can also throw money at the judiciary. Not, I hasten to add, in quite as direct or effective a manner as the offer to bankroll a congressman's future campaign for a re-election or to fly him to Hawaii for a holiday. Nevertheless, interest groups can hire more and better lawyers than more widely diffused groups of consumers or small producers. And in that vein, Hirschleifer again stated that he saw several flaws in the Posner argument that the law does, after all, tend to evolve in the direction of efficiency. And that I put down under quote R. And indeed, Posner partially accepted such arguments. When he accepted, I quote, that an efficient rule, the social costs of which are widely diffused, will not evoke efforts at corrective litigation because no one harmed by it will have a significant stake in getting the rule changed, while on the other hand, an efficient rule that imposes concentrated costs, say on a particular industry, may well evoke such efforts. Two crucial elements that enhance the power of the lobbyist in the USA are the relative weakness of the party whip and the importance for congressmen of amassing their own financial funds to support their re-election. These factors mean that lobbyists can often target a relatively small number of congressmen who can be persuaded to shift their votes from the rest of their party in order successfully to pass or prevent the passage of some act. Now, those conditions do not hold to anything like the same extent in the UK. The strength of the party whip in Parliament, the dominance of the executive over the legislature, and our constraints on electoral funding mean that interest groups generally have to persuade a major party, preferably that currently in power, to accept their programme in order to get it adopted. Interest group lobbyists can and do try to bend the ear of key individual members of the executive, notably ministers and senior officials in the relevant ministries, as well as members of parliament in the legislature. But our political structure nevertheless seems more robust and resistant to the influence of the interest group than in the USA. If anything, the problem may be the reverse, that the lack of checks and balances within the UK political system allows the dominant executive in Parliament to push through legislation quite rapidly, often on a tide of widespread popular emotion, legislation whose overall effects, costs, and benefits have not been lengthily, calmly, and coolly assessed. Though, of course, it is the role of the House of Lords, in part, to try to do so. In my own field of financial regulation, the laws and statutes that have been enacted in recent decades, the two banking acts and the Financial Services Act, were in each case patently introduced in response to a perceived crisis or failing in the existing system. When the public and the media insist that such and such a failing must never be allowed to happen again, the government of the day is all too ready to rush through legislation to assuage such demands without necessarily having undertaken proper assessment of collateral and associated effects elsewhere through the system. In the UK context, the likelihood of the majority, stampeded by emotional stories in the press, imposing excessive costs on an industrial or sectoral minority, is rather greater. Witness, for example, the handling of BSE, than it would appear to be in the USA, where all the academic emphasis is on the cohesive minority interest group, hoodwinking the majority. Be that as it may, governmental action and statute law is unlikely ever to achieve an exactly correct balance between competing interests, between the many and the few. But the fact that statute law is thereby fallible does not, however, mean that there is any better procedure for addressing society's problems than provided by representative democracy and an independent judiciary in a world in which the cozy and bargaining process is constrained by a shortage of time, the main element of transactions costs, and by asymmetries of power. Let me now conclude. To recapitulate briefly, I myself would wish to shift the balance in the common area in which law and economics overlap very, very slightly in three distinct ways. One, I would like to encourage economists to become more aware of the importance of the legal infrastructure. Secondly, I would like to suggest to both economists and lawyers some of the limits to the economic analysis of the law. And finally, to suggest that in the UK at least, statute law is as likely to become unbalanced by the pressures of a stampeded majority as by the lobbying actions of a cohesive, calculating minority interest group. Thank you very much.
To a Chorley lecture, at least in this room. I'm instructed by the committee to invite all of you present to come one floor down, where some kinds of beverage will await you, to accompany the remarkable menu of thought that we have heard this evening. I can't believe that this will not give rise to a new reform of the LLB syllabus in regard to the relationship with economics. Indeed, some colleagues may not believe this, but I remember my first professor's meeting coming here from elsewhere back in the 60s, There was discussion as to whether, as it were, a resident economist should be appointed to the department staff. I don't think that's ever happened, but tonight's menu must surely change the agenda in many ways in that respect. It's not for me at this point to try and choose particular items. We're extremely grateful for what will stand as a remarkable Chorley lecture. Thank you very much.